require no plumbing, and the elements don't have to be replaced every 4 to 6 months. Perfect for anyone on a tight budget. And more importantly, if there's an unexpected emergency, your loved ones will be prepared. That's because Berkey systems are able to purify raw, untreated water. Check out our Christmas specials at BerkeyWater.com. With one of our quantity specials, you not only get a discount, but in one stop, you can get gifts for the entire family. That's BerkeyWater.com or call 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, of course, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Colonel Barry Turner. And Colonel Turner was with the British military, was an engineer there for many years. He's retired now. But he's very, very concerned about the fact that there is an organized effort to destroy the sovereignty of Great Britain and bring about this European Union, which will, of course, bring to an end Great Britain's, you know, noble tradition of sovereignty and freedom under the Magna Carta and under the laws of England. And unfortunately, there are very, very powerful forces working behind the scenes in Europe and in the United States whose loyalty is not to national sovereignty. They really want to bring about a world government, and the European Union is the first step along that way, along that line. And, of course, you must understand that this is largely being financed from right here in the United States. It is our leaders that want, of course, this world government, but you can't tell the American people that. That's your tax money is being used to transform Great Britain, to transform all of Europe. And not only that, but then, of course, oh, they're doing the same thing here in the United States. They want to do away with our sovereignty and merge us with Mexico and Canada. They know exactly what they're doing, and they're doing everything they can to deceive the American people. Colonel Turner, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Hello, thank you for having me again.
Well, let's. Why don't we talk a little bit about what happened as far as the Irish vote against the European Union. I think that's fascinating. I mean, the only reason they let the Irish people vote is because they figured that they'd embrace the European Union. And when they rejected it by 54% to 46%, why, the powers that be, the people who really run the European Union behind the scenes, they were pretty upset, weren't they?
Yes, they were. It's a very murky situation at the moment, because there was a long wait for the Irish to vote, and they did vote against the Lisbon Treaty. Now, it was stated during the campaigning, immediately before the voting, that, you know, not many people understood what it was all about anyway. And this, of course, is something that's frustrated everybody along the line for many years. All these documents are voluminous things, and I rather doubt if that many of our 650 members of Parliament have ever read them or fully understood them. But, of course, they vote with the party whip as a block. And in this case, of course, the present socialist government is firmly for Europe. The Conservative government bounces around like a cork on water, because they've got some very powerful individuals within the party who are determinedly pro-Europe. Kenneth Clark is a typical example, and he's a former minister under Margaret Thatcher. But you see, he also is a leading member of the Bilderberg Group, and I think he's now taken over as the permanent member from the aging Lord Carrington, who's well into his 80s.
And of course,
we have all these complications.
Well, of course, the Bilderbergers are intent upon world government. David Rockefeller, of course, is one of the leading members, been there since 1953 when they were founded. But then so is the Trilateral Commission, so is the Council on Foreign Relations, so is the Club of Rome, and all of these powerful and wealthy individuals who work within the shadows in these covert organizations are really intent upon bringing about the New World Order and the New World Religion, because that goes hand in hand. Love with it, and then of course establishing, I believe, and eventually either ruled by an oligarchy or ruled by a one world ruler. And that seems to be exactly what's going on. We're going to be back here in just a moment. We're going to be bringing on some news stations right at this point. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Colonel Barry Turner, who, of course, served with the British military as an engineer for many years. He's retired now, but he is very, very concerned about the move to destroy Britain's national sovereignty and merge it into the European Union, which is simply one of the organizations being created throughout the world to bring about this one world government. And of course, as I mentioned just a moment or two ago, all of these covert groups, which you will never see described in your local newspaper, the Bilderbergers, which met last week, the Council on Foreign Relations, which of course is now occasionally mentioned, although prior to 10 years ago, even though it had existed from 1921, was never mentioned in the media until about 10 years ago. Certainly the Trilateral Commission, the Club of Rome, these wealthy and powerful elitists are intent upon a world government. And Colonel Turner was just saying that one of the key members of the Conservative Party, now the Liberal Party over there in Great Britain, of course they want to do away with British sovereignty and join the European Union. Despite the fact that the average Britisher doesn't want, they don't care what the British people want, but Colonel Turner was just saying that one of the leading members of the Conservative Party now, a member of the Bilderbergers, is also pushing the other political party, the two main parties, of course, Liberal and Conservative, into this whole idea of the world government. Now, who is this gentleman you were speaking of, Colonel?
Kenneth Clark, you
right,
mentioned.
Right.
Yes. The whole question of Europe, and I don't pretend to be an expert. A lot of people study this in fine detail, and of course I cover a much wider range of international interests, national interests. But, you have the constitutional treaty, which was supposed to wrap up the Maastricht Treaty, as I understand it. You had the Lisbon Treaty, which was intended, we are told, to moderate the central power of the European Union, in that our independence judicial system should survive, and that we could opt out of certain European measures. Now, as far as I know, very few people on the street really understand this. As I said, these documents are voluminous. What I have here, a two-page letter from a Liberal Democratic Party MP, Lembit Opik. Now, it's a two-page letter to a relative of mine trying to explain what is happening with the Lisbon Treaty.
All right, now, hold that thought for just a moment, because we want to bring our other stations back on, and I'd like you to explain what the Lisbon Treaty is. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Colonel Turner was about to explain what the Lisbon Treaty is. Now, for those of you who don't remember, it was a few years ago when, of course, I think it was France and Denmark were allowed to vote on the European Union, and they voted against it. So, of course, that did not dissuade the people who really run the world. It doesn't matter what the people want. They have an agenda, and so basically then they came up with the Lisbon Treaty as an alternative. And, well, we really don't have to have the European A constitution ratified, we'll have the Lisbon Treaty, which will do exactly the same thing, but it'll be done by the parliaments, it'll be done by the ruling elite, and then of course the people would be expected to agree, because after all we're nations of law, and as long as the laws are passed by parliament and by the finest politicians that money could buy, why of course the people then will follow along, or they become lawbreakers. So what is the Lisbon Treaty, and what is, you were going to tell us about, somebody had written a letter to try to explain it.
I wish I knew what the Lisbon Treaty was. In broad brush, it is said that the Lisbon Treaty moderates the Maastricht Treaty in that there will be opt-out clauses insofar as we may retain our judicial system, for instance, instead of being forced to adopt the European judicial system, our trial by jury and habeas corpus and that sort of thing, and we shall be able to opt out from selected measures where we are in disagreement. Now, the extent to which this would work is a mystery to me, and probably to most people. But you see, Lemidov Opik is trying to explain what each of the three major parties are backing or allowing or not allowing. And we have the Conservative Party, we have the Labour Party, which is really socialist, international socialist in nature, and the Liberal Democratic Party, which is Opik's party. Now, one faction suggests that they would back a referendum for our membership per se of the European Union. Another would back a referendum on the Maastricht Treaty, which really put the kibosh on our independence some years ago, and the Lisbon Treaty. Now, clearly the parties themselves are manoeuvring for position, and nobody is entirely coming clean. What we do know is that some time ago, Prime Minister Blair promised the people of this country a referendum, and they have reneged on that referendum.
They've reneged on it, but they refused to go along with it. Then didn't the Prime Minister Brown, when he came to power, promise the British people he'd have a referendum, and then he changed his mind as well?
Well, I think Brown, of course, has inherited a bag of nails, and the evidence is that he is not in a strong position after 10 years of socialist government, and the mess they've made of things, made of many things. And his legacy is an unfortunate one, but I don't think he's a strong leader anyway. That's the general impression that comes through the media, and that's my impression. And he shilly-shallied, just as he shilly-shallied over calling a general election. And now we're in a sort of no-man's land. And you see, they're all already talking about the Irish vote, no vote, as being discarded. And there's talk in the media of a two-tier European Union.
In other words, basically what they're saying is we don't care what the Irish people want. They're the only ones we allowed to vote because we thought that they'd go along with it. They wouldn't go along with it, so we'll just ignore what they have to say. And people have to understand that's democracy. That's why Plato wrote,
democracy is meaningless. I think we all know this. The two-party system, and ours is basically a two-party system with the Conservative and the Socialist parties. Liberal Democrats are a relative minority, but not without no power. In the United States, you have two major parties.
And
the electorate really only sees democracy as an illusion when it is allowed to vote for one or the other. Beyond that, there's a total rubber wall between the electorate and any serious national or international issues. Local issues, of course. Your members of Parliament are only too keen to be seen in the local newspaper, culling votes on promising local issues. But you tackle them on anything serious, like the invasion of Iraq in 2003, they don't want to know. You just get rebuffed. Possibly, if you get a reply which has any meaning, it is a standard reply which is sent to anybody who raises such a subject. So we're still at sea at the moment, but the indications are that those powers within the European Union are jolly well determined that they are going to press along with a European Union as such. You see, the original coal and steel community treaty was published I had a copy of the original, but it's gone walkabout, I'm afraid. But I've got the command paper published in 1972. This is a government command paper published by Her Majesty's Stationery Office. And in 1951, although this country did not accede to the treaty at that time, the institutions of the community are stated as being a high authority assisted by a consultative committee, a common assembly, hereafter called the assembly, a special council of ministers, hereinafter called the council, and a court of justice. Now, quite clearly, these are the four elements that have been perpetuated. But the foundation was laid in 1951. And when one considers this to be a coal and steel community treaty, we're talking about coal and steel. It's an umbrella document in that sense, an umbrella title. But you see, from the very outset, these four elements which persist today, the high authority, which is the bureaucracy, which is oppressive, singularly oppressive, the common assembly, well, members of the European Parliament, we call them, MEPs, who have precious little power, and it's a rag bag covering the many nations who are members. A special council of ministers, well, that speaks for itself, and a court of justice, the European Court of Justice. So the blueprint was laid then, and we've been sleepwalked into this ever since. And I'm afraid this is the position we've reached. But you see, my linchpin for all this is what I've already spoken of before, the words of Nicholas Murray Butler, the American Fabian, in 1937, that communism is the instrument with which the financial world can topple national governments and then erect a world government with a world police and world power.
And that's really what it's all about. They want this world government, which will, of course, be a socialist authoritarian society. And, of course, you know, when they were first putting together this steel agreement back in 1951, they told the people of Europe and Great Britain, this has nothing to do with government. We are not going to establish a government. It only has to do with trade. Just as here in the United States, they're telling us, oh, our agreements with Mexico and Canada have nothing to do with establishing a government and destroying the sovereignty of America. It all has to do with trade. And they're simply lying because the American people would never go along with the destruction of our sovereignty and, of course, bring the same freedom to America that exists in Mexico, bringing, of course, raising the living standards of the average American to that of the Mexican peasant. The American people would be furious, but that's what they really intend, but they cannot tell the people because the people are not sophisticated enough to understand that the elite know what's good for them. And it's true here, it's true over in Europe. You have an elite intent upon this world government, and then they're imposing it on Great Britain, they're imposing it upon Europe. And what's really happened in Europe, specifically in Germany, is the people, you know, who actually had pensions, you know, they've lost about almost between half and two-thirds of the value of their life savings. Certainly they expanded, you know, the German influence into Eastern Europe and, of course, with the European Union and all, why they had to then, of course, to lower the standards of the German-speaking people. As they raise the standards of the people of Eastern Europe, and that's exactly what they're going to do with America, raising our living standards to that of the Mexican peasant. But you go right ahead, Barry.
You're absolutely right. And, of course, the ordinary people are starved of information. They've been deliberately diverted by a sort of bread and circuses culture. And as the days go by, they know less and less. And, of course, they've been encouraged to be interested in less and less. And I don't think there's any doubt about this, but I'd like to cover some of this diversion, what I call the moral and mental meltdown, if we have time.
Go right ahead.
You see, apart from Nicholas Murray Butler, another factor in this scheme of things was the Frankfurt School for Social Research, which was founded to further the aims of Marxism when armed struggle failed to take root. It was the ideological struggle founded in 1923 to work to destroy the family, discipline, morality, inheritance, religion, culture, and tradition, and so on and so forth. Now, they've been very successful because they have worked through the educational system, through the media, And this is the real socialism that now infuses the higher reaches of the establishment like a virus.
And, Chris, I think it's so important for people to understand that socialism, they talk about redistribution of wealth. They're talking about redistribution of wealth to the middle class, not of the extremely wealthy people. I mean, the extremely wealthy people are not going to be under the same laws and regulations that those common people are. And when you understand this, it is an elitist concept. That is, of course, why an elitist group got Karl Marx to write the Communist Manifesto. It was an elitist group called the League of the Just. Bet you didn't learn that in school. Look it up in the dictionary encyclopedia. The League of the Just paid Karl Marx to write the Communist Manifesto to confuse the people. Well, Colonel, go right ahead.
There always is money behind any sort of revolution. No revolution takes place without some form of finance. And, of course, the League of the Just is something that you won't learn in textbooks. You won't learn it through any school curriculum. They don't want you to know, as we're only too well aware. We have then, of course, the attack on the middle classes. This is an old chestnut. Because the middle classes are the potentially thinking classes, and a very broad band of responsible people, largely, and they're the biggest danger, and they have to be melted down, as it were, destabilized. And this is what this game is all about. What is interesting also is that we have this left-right terminology, which again, is a diversion from the truth. And anything right-wing tends to be attributed a fascist or Nazi connotation. Extreme right, hard right, neo-fascist, you name it. Now, this is going down the wrong path, because it invokes a vision of Nazi Germany, which was a singular period of 10, 15 years before the war and into the Second World War. What we're really talking about is not Nazi Germany, although some of the techniques are much the same. What we're talking about is socialism. And, of course, national socialism was practiced in Germany, so we're still with socialism. What we have to face is international Fabian socialism. Now, the battle is nationalism versus internationalism, as has been repeated many times. And anybody who defends nationhood or the national culture is inevitably vilified as neo-fascist, hard-right, far-right, and this sort of connotation. Internationalism is international socialism. And this takes us back to Nicholas Murray Butler and the role of communism. In fact, communism is Marxist socialism put into practice in the Soviet Union after the revolution. But you see, we're being conditioned. And I mentioned before the Chronicles of Dissent, in which Noam Chomsky talks to David Barsamian. Now, it's quite clear from that that we are taught and told exactly what the powers that be wish us to be taught and told, if at all, through the media and through the educational institutions and so on. Now, this, of course, means that we are starved of the truth, in short. Now, the use of statistics, that's an interesting one. I thought of one particular quirky reference. Sort of, you know, one thinks of these things in one bath. Now, the tennis champion, Steffi Graf, never defeated my mother once at Wimbledon or in any game of tennis. Perfectly true. True statement. The fact that Steffi Graf was a Wimbledon champion and my mother was a frail 80-year-old is irrelevant to the statement, because when I say Steffi Graf never defeated my mother at Wimbledon, it's a true statement.
But of course your mother wasn't playing.
We're fed statistics in the same way. We're fed information in the same way through the media. Statistics are interesting in the medical field.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Colonel Turner is making the point about statistics. You know, the old adage is statistics don't lie, or figures don't lie, but liars can figure. And so much of what we're told about so many things just is not true. Colonel Turner was talking about how one of the world champion tennis players was never able to defeat his mother at Wimbledon. Of course, there was reason, because his mother was 85 years old and she didn't play tennis at Wimbledon. But the statement can be made that the tennis champion never defeated Colonel Turner's mother, and that's an absolutely true statement. But it's only a half-truth, because they never actually played tennis, did they?
Absolutely.
So, understand, ladies and gentlemen...
It's almost a case of that old military term, bullshit baffles brains.
Right.
But you see, statistics. Now, smoking, the anti-smoking campaign, has been a particular interest of mine. It was brought to my notice by a retired scientist well over 20 years ago. Now, in the medical field, where they want to make points, they quote statistics, as in other fields, and frequently political statements are made about, with statistics. They talk huge sums of money across the floor of the House of Commons. One side says, we put X million into the National Health Service. Another one will say, we put X million into education. And this exchange of statistics, of course, is rubbish, because nobody, to my mind, ever substantiates these statistics. In the case of health, they may say, so many thousand die from smoking every year. So many thousand die from heart attacks every year. So many thousand die from obesity, which is a current bogey. Now, this has become something of an obsession, a cultivated obsession, rather like smoking, because smoking has almost vanished. Now, if you add up these statistics, you know, we'd have no population left. But it's a game that is played without any attempt, as I say, to substantiate them. And the public tends to accept them without question. Except those who think. It's interesting in the medical field that the retiring editor, I can't remember whether it was the Lancet or the British Medical Association journal, the BMA journal, the two leading medical journals anyway, the retiring editor wrote in the Guardian newspaper that he had been forced to publish what he knew was corrupt research. In other words, the power behind the BMA journal and the Lancet was such, largely, I suspect, through pharmaceutical corporations with their highly qualified research, in inverted commas, were, you know, able to get their corrupt material published. Another one was in 1953, where the John Swinton, the former chief of staff of the New York Times, said at a dinner at the New York Press Club that there is no such thing as an independent press. There is not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. I am paid weekly for keeping my honest opinion out of the paper. Now, he goes on, we are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes, which I'm sure will strike a chord. We are jumping jacks, they pull the strings, and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Now, that's coming straight from the shoulder. And it gives one a pretty good picture of exactly how we are being lied to and conditioned. Continuously. And when you bear in mind that was in 1953, it's only got worse.
Well, we are glad to provide for any of our listeners an article that appeared in the Washington Post, written by Richard Harwood for many years. Of course, he was in charge of the editorial page there at the Washington Post. But here he writes, now he's retired, and he's actually, you know, the the gentleman who's supposed to oversee and make sure things are done correctly. And he simply points out about the Council on Foreign Relations and how they totally control our government. Anybody would like to see this, it's called ruling class journalism and how the people in the media are not telling the truth. Now, this is written by Richard Harwood, former editorial page writer from the Washington Post. We'd be glad to send any of our listeners a copy of that article. You are not supposed to know, or you're not supposed to understand the truth about what's really going on in the world today. You're supposed to believe the media, even though, of course, here in the United States, 5 mega corporations control our media. AOL, Time Warner, Bertelsmann, Viacom, Disney, and Fox. 90 to 95% of all the media is controlled by those major corporations, and they determine pretty well what the American people believe, what they hear, read, and see. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here and with Colonel Barry Turner. Go right ahead, Colonel.
Well, again, one can only quote in this country Richard Murdoch.
Is that Richard or Rupert Murdoch?
Murdoch. Murdoch.
Right. Anyway. Is that Rupert Murdoch of Rupert?
Rupert Murdoch. Right,
go ahead.
Richard Murdoch was a comedian. And
right.
I got the name wrong. Yes, there's no connection, as you can imagine. Murdoch is deadly serious, the Rupert Murdoch. But you see, legislation during John Major's government allowed cross-media ownership. It was coming, and it was objected to. It was resisted by a number of politicians. But nevertheless, it went through. And people like Murdoch have gone from strength to strength, controlling everything. But other things are beginning to bubble here. We've had the Lisbon Treaty. The other things that are bubbling here, I think the middle classes, however they may be defined, and they never are really defined, it's again a triggered term, but the middle classes, what they now coyly call in the Guardian newspaper, Middle England, in fact I think generally it's a term, it avoids the social connotation, the social class connotation, and gives you a much wider view of the spectrum, because wealth has been redistributed over the last 50 years, there's no doubt about that. And a lot of highly skilled technical people, who used to be the men I worked with on the shop floor during my apprenticeship, very skilled tradesmen in blue overalls, to a large extent vanished with our industry, our heavy engineering industry, which have vanished. And we've got this class of young people in technical jobs, and it's broadened this middle class spectrum. But you see, they are intelligent, and they think, and there's a lot of resistance now to what has been going on in the economic field, and of course we've had the mortgage meltdown. And a lot of these young people have struggled to establish their own homes and are paying heavy mortgage dues. And there is also a growing resistance to the oppression, the bureaucratic oppression, much of it coming through the European Union, but much of it coming through oppressive socialist measures, the Sovietization of the family and so on. And David Davis, the Conservative Party spokesman on Home Affairs.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment with Colonel Turner. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Colonel Turner, Colonel Barry Turner. Before we go on into Richard Davis, I would like you, if you have a website to get that out or anything you'd like, of course, for our listeners to know about the work that you're doing over there trying to educate the people of Great Britain. Do you have a website at all?
Do I have a website?
Yes,
I'm afraid not.
All right, fine. Is there a website that you could recommend to our listeners who wanted to know about this move towards the destruction of the sovereignty of Great Britain?
Offhand, I couldn't give you one.
All right, fine.
I could find one.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, you go right ahead then with your story about Mr. Davis and why is he significant?
Well, David Davis bucked his Conservative Party leader, David Cameron. They were rivals for the leadership a couple of years ago. But David Davis has resigned on the grounds of this growing oppression of the public, petty legislation, petty bureaucracy, which is causing enormous resentment. The powers of the police, which are excessive, and the ridiculous excessive exercise of police powers in certain circumstances, arresting old ladies for minor offences, to meet their targets, amongst other things. And the public, of course, Middle England, are getting absolutely fed up with it. In fact, political correctness lies at the heart of most of this, in my view. And, of course, political correctness is the Marxist system of mind control and forcing people to conform to the socialist ideal. They're not allowed to think for themselves. Now, it's caused waves here, because had the Tory party taken a strong stand on the oppressive bureaucracy emanating from Europe and the bureaucracy at home, and promised to reverse it and kept the pressure up, they, I reckon, would have won on a landslide. Had they added a referendum on the European treaty, then they would also get in on a landslide. But they are shilly-shallying around with petty pork barrel type issues, trying to cull votes on the short term on opportunist issues, and they're getting nowhere. And David Davis has jumped ship. It's embarrassed the Tory party, and of course the Labour party, the socialists in other words, are making hay with this one. He wanted to precipitate a by-election in his constituency by standing again, and it looks as though there will be no Labour candidate put up against him, so it'll be a bit of a damp squib. But other things are popping up too. We've had a long-standing exposure now for several months of corruption within firstly the Labour Party, and this began with Lord Levy and his contributions to the Labour Party and his organisation of contributions to the Labour Party from various sources. And then other individuals have been exposed. Rather interestingly, a lot of this has come through the Jewish Chronicle, but it's hit the mainstream press as well. Now, this, of course, has meant that the parties are on the lookout for corruption, real or imagined, amongst each other, amongst their opponents. And it's not the Labour Party which is being hammered at the moment. The Conservative Party is being hammered. But you take an example that erupted today. A well-known Conservative Member of Parliament, Nicholas Winterton, owns a flat in London, which is worth about £780,000, I think it was. We can double that for dollars, roughly. Now, he owns his flat. He formed a family trust, which is quite legal, an inheritance trust for his children. They, in fact, own the flat. And the trust, charges the government the rent that Winterton pays his own trust for renting the flat. In other words, it's a flat that he directly or indirectly owns. He rents it from the trust and is paid for it by the government. In other words, he's getting something like $250,000 a year, which he's no right to. I mean, legally you can argue it. And you're finding this continuously. Ministers or members of parliament employing their families, and there have been a number of scandals here, employing their wives, daughters, sons, relatives as researchers, as secretaries, and this sort of thing. And it's causing a very nasty smell. So this one is not likely to go away, but we've always had this vision of the British system being squeaky clean. Clearly it's far from it. John Reid, a former defence secretary under Blair, was revealed as having a wealthy United States wife. Now, this is a down-to-earth socialist. A wealthy American wife and an offshore property portfolio. Now, this doesn't make sense either. It's a contradiction in terms for any Labour minister to be in that position financially.
But I think that many people really should understand that the real force behind the labor socialist movement has always been people of great wealth. Until people understand that, this is why we have so many people of great wealth in our United States Senate today. And so many of those people there who are pushing the radical left, all power to the government agenda, are really, of course, they're socialists, but they are elitists, realizing that socialism has nothing to do with helping the common man. It has everything to do with the elite controlling the common man and establishing a feudalistic sort of society. That's what's really going on in England today. That's what's going on in America today. Go right ahead, Colonel.
Well, there's a story going back 50 years. He's dead now, but a Labour, well-known, famous Labour Party politician immediately after the war. The story was that he drove to his constituency in his Rolls Royce, parked up his Rolls Royce, put on a cloth cap, and went campaigning in a little car, a little Morris 8. Now, it may have been apocryphal, but this, again, is fairly typical of the attitudes. Another bubble which has burst in the last 12 months concerns the armed forces. Now, in this general climate under a weak Prime Minister Brown, weakened after 10 years of Tony Blair, General Sir Richard Dammett, the chief of the general staff, in other words, he's the head of the army, not the chief of the defense staff, who is an air marshal. But General Sir Richard Dammett has come out very strongly, he came out very strongly some time ago, about the state of the army, the treatment of the soldiers, medical and equipment-wise, support-wise, pay-wise, accommodation-wise. And he made it very forcefully. Now, it's almost unheard of for a serving officer to stand up and be counted like this. Now, he's come out again quite recently, photographed in uniform in the newspapers, hammering the government about their disgraceful treatment of the armed forces in terms of equipment, accommodation, some of which I know is appalling. It was appalling when I was serving. The dreadful lack of consideration for injured servicemen and their pay rates. Now, he's Dammett has talked about a soldier earning less than a traffic warden. A soldier putting his life at risk in Afghanistan, Iraq, with a very turbulent domestic life because of all the movement abroad, home and abroad and away again, earning less than a traffic warden. And we've just had a tanker driver strike. Petrol tanker drivers strike, which has almost brought the nation to its knees, but not quite, and it's been settled. Now, tanker drivers get something in the order of between $60,000 and, I think it's about, just under, about, say, $75,000 a year. Now, in this climate, what price the wages of a tank driver, who is far more vulnerable, who operates in highly dangerous circumstances. You see, this imbalance has provoked the service chiefs to stand up and be counted. His predecessor, General Sir Michael Jackson, who was regarded as a hard man, never went public. He only went public when he retired, and he has far less respect than Dammett. But you see, it's another sign of a nation in trouble, because for this to happen, he's quite serious. He's standing up and criticizing his own government. And it's jolly well necessary as well, as anybody in the services will know. The other one, of course, is terrorism. Now, the terrorism problem rumbles on. Now, we have, again, very oppressive legislation about tackling terrorism, the rules of detention of suspects. But, you see, it's a double-edged one, this tackling terrorism, and I think it takes us into a rather broader field. The I see the explanation of a lot of this in a Samuel P. Huntington piece some years ago. It was either War or the Clash of Civilizations.
It was called The Clash of Civilizations, that's right. He wrote both an article for the Foreign Affairs magazine. He wrote a book by that title, The Clash of Civilizations. And he warned us from never trying to go over there into the Muslim world and try to get them to adhere to our way of life. You know, don't try to impose your life on the Muslims or you'll get into a quicksand from which there's no extracting yourself. And so what did the Bush administration do? They went over there into the Islamic world and tried to force them to accept democracy, to accept our sense of morality, to accept our sense of courts. And these people don't want it. And we've created a more terrorism than ever existed on September 11th. More and more people are being recruited into the radical Islamic movement because of the actions of the British government and the American government working in concert, trying to force the Muslim world to adhere to our values rather than their values. And I'm not sure that that our values are so much superior to their values. I don't like the way they treat women, but at least they have a certain respect for them. They're not totally sex objects. And I dare say that there's no Muslim country that has 60 million inhabitants that have a sexually transmitted viral disease like we have here in the United States.
Yes, absolutely. You see, it's a very double-edged one. It's a very complex one. But terrorism per se is a term that has been subsumed to mean any faction which opposes Western interests of the kind you just mentioned. Now, terrorism is not that. It is properly defined by a German colonel who was colonel on the Russian front during the war. Freiherr von der Heydt. He was a brigadier in the reserve army afterwards, and he was also a university professor. And he wrote a book called Modern Irregular Warfare, in which he makes it quite clear that those methods used by terrorists, as we call them, are methods used because they do not have access to sophisticated modern weapons and huge armed forces. It's no different to the resistance to the Germans in France, by the Maquis, or behind the lines in Eastern Europe, or in Greece and the Balkans during the Second World War. But you see, the term has been distorted. And I had occasion to take to task an extremely nice chap called Stephen Green, who founded an organization called Christian Voice. Now, they have a well-produced newsletter which comes out every month. And it's a question of Christian Voice being founded as a reaction against the attack on Christianity, Christian values, the wholesale, all-round us attack. And, of course, you have an action and reaction. He's been noted lately for fighting Jerry Springer's pornographic show. Well, it's not pornographic, it's a blasphemous show. It's blasphemous references to treatment of Christianity. And some theatres, some places of entertainment around the country have been forced to take his show off or not stage it. Now, he wrote a very strong piece about Islam in the Christian Voice newsletter recently, and it was really a broad brush attack on the terrorist element of Islam. And I had to point out to him that, you know, it is not that simple. I mean, we already have a situation in which Madeleine Albright can say in the Christian West, the so-called Christian West, "Thou shalt not kill," that 500,000 Iraqi children who died as a result of sanctions before the 2003 invasion were a price worth paying. That's a heinous statement to make. And I said to Stephen, he lives in South Wales, near Carmarthen, I said, how many of your friends, neighbours and relatives have lost arms, legs, or been blinded recently? When did the last bomb go off in Carmarthen marketplace? When you travel along the motorway to London, how many roadside bombs do you have to dodge You see, this is the situation. We don't have Westminster Abbey occupied as an American barracks, or Buckingham Palace occupied as a military headquarters. Now, this is what we've done to a country that never threatened anybody. They might have postured. We knew at the time, in the case of Iraq, that they had no weapons of mass destruction. That was a lie perpetuated by Blair, another Christian.
I would be hesitant to really call him a Christian. He may pose as a Christian, but certainly you judge a person not by what they say, but what they do. And Terry Blair was a consistent liar.
Yes, absolutely. I'm using Christian in inverted commas, I should say, who's been accepted, I believe, into the Catholic Church. Unbelievable. But he's a vainglorious liar. He's a Walter Mitty character, shallow, in my view. Noam Chomsky, of course, sent me a very acid description of his Blair some years ago. And he fiddled UN Resolution 1441 with the aid of the Lord Goldsmith, anyway, legal advice.
I think it's very interesting that today, after, of course, being literally driven out of Great Britain, Tony Blair is now the chief negotiator for the Quartet. What is the Quartet? It's the most powerful, one of the most powerful organizations in the world. It's made up of United States, Russia, European Union, United Nations, and they are going to force a peaceful solution on the Israelis and the Palestinians. And, of course, I'm sure he'll be as successful there as he was in Great Britain. Tony Blair is a disreputable individual, long-time chief of the secret Fabian Socialist Organization, ultimately came to be the Prime Minister of Great Britain. And there's not one person, probably in 1,000 Great Britain, who even knows that Tony Blair headed the Fabian Socialist Secret Society. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, Colonel Turner, you have about 3 minutes to wrap up this afternoon's program.
I got about 10 pages of notes. I'm still on page one.
All right, well, of course, you know, do you think the average individual over there really even understands the Fabian Socialists?
But we discuss this endlessly here amongst a limited number, half a dozen perhaps locally, who are prepared to face these issues and take an interest. They're all people who've traveled, lived outside the borough, and they've got a much broader view of things, and they're much more concerned because they can understand what's going on. And we believe firmly we have to get young people involved, one way or another, be it the internet, or by the press, local newspapers. We have to get young people we know are concerned. They're often blamed for being, for misbehaving and so on and so forth. There are a lot of young people who think responsibly. They sit in groups and talk, and it's very difficult to get close to them because unless you have a direct contact, it's not easy to relate to them. But young people, and we have also got to get rid of some of the deadwood in our local government institutions.
We are
elected town and borough councillors, as we call them.
Well, you know, basically here in the United States, with the Ron Paul Revolution, why, of course, there have been a lot of people, a lot of young people got involved, because Ron Paul was saying what they wanted. They wanted to talk about liberty and freedom. The older people just like the way the system is working right now. We're doing pretty well financially. We're all set up. We don't want to rock the boat, but the young people do, and I think the most exciting thing that I've seen probably in decades is the number of young people who are suddenly getting involved. For instance, they had the meeting of the Bilderbergers just last week, and there were large numbers of young people outside demonstrating against the Bilderbergers. We have not seen this amount of enthusiasm, and I don't think in the last 30 or 40 years, so I'm really guardedly optimistic.
Well, in the Army, in my young days, we had a term for the people who didn't want to make waves. We used to call them stumble bums.
Right.
But, we have people being elected mayor 2 and 3 times. That's because there's no competition. There's nobody to displace them. Displace rather than replace, in my view. You see, we need this new blood, and we have got to start the battle at the grassroots, without any doubt.
I agree with you, but we're out of time, Colonel. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. We'll look forward to having you again sometime real soon. Our guest has been Colonel Barry Turner from Great Britain, talking about the plight of the British people. Good night. God bless.
Thank you very much indeed. Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. How do we really understand what's going on in the world? How do we understand these people of great wealth and great power who want socialism, who want to bring about a European Union and a North American Union and a South American Union? And, of course, they want to destroy sovereignty and they want then to bring about the world government? Well, certainly one of the best things we've put together is called The World Revolution. And, of course, it's a talk we've given. There you'll actually see my interview with Ambassador Earl T. Smith, American ambassador to Cuba at the time of the Cuban Revolution back in 1959. He will tell you that the State Department and the CIA were instrumental in bringing Fidel Castro to power, and they knew he was a communist. They knew he was a communist, and what happened in Cuba was simply part of the world revolution, this continuing revolution which is unfolding today. In fact, we just saw it in Nepal where the American State Department was backing the Maoists who were intent upon overthrowing the king. And the reason we're in, we've got to keep our troops permanently stationed in the Middle East, is so we can control the Muslim world. In fact, we're probably going to go to war with them. Do you know a better way to gain control over the Muslim world and force the leaders there to go ahead and do what we want, because it's all about empire? Well, certainly the DVD, World Revolution, we recommend to you. The book, Fire in the Minds of Men, written by James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, is a very important book because he talks about the Illuminati, about the secret societies, and though he doesn't talk about them here in the United States, because, of course, he's part and parcel of them himself, he does tell you about the history of these organizations, starting with the time of the French Revolution. Now, of course, to put things into proper perspective, you need to, of course, hear my talk on the forbidden secret. And then, of course, associated with that, you'll want to get the syllabus. You'll certainly want to get the great new DVD we have by Dr. Garth Nicholson. Dr. Garth Nichols, I should say, is entitled Terrible New Diseases. How many people do you know that have chronic fatigue, who have fibromyalgia, who have Lyme's disease, who have diseases that nobody can quite figure out what's wrong with them, but they're just tired, they don't feel good? Well, of course, you need to get this new DVD by one of the outstanding scientists in our nation. It's very well done. Of course, we have his PowerPoint presentation as part of this DVD. We have a book written by a former defector from the Soviet Union, a contemporary of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was released in exchange for a Russian spy that was being held in the West. The book is called EUSSR, European EUSSR, because the European Union is simply a continuation of the authoritarian society that exists in Russia today. How could that be? Well, you must understand there's always been an alliance between our leaders and the leaders of the world communist movement. That's why our pamphlet, The Communist-Capitalist Alliance, is so important. The Communist-Capitalist Alliance is an inexpensive little pamphlet, but you need to get it. You need to get my interview with Professor Sutton, formerly with the Hoover Institute, except they had to get rid of him because he was telling the truth. And you can't have anybody in an academic institution who's really telling the truth. But the interview is called The Best Enemy Money Could Buy. The Best Enemy Money Could Buy. It's available on DVD. It's a classic. And then, of course, we also have Professor Sutton's book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, and Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, both of them, of course, were manufactured right here in the United States. Understand that this is not imaginary. It's really very real. We hope that many of you go to our website of RadioLiberty.com. Not only pull down the newsletters that are there, you can, of course, listen to our programs free of charge. You can pull down our DVDs and watch them free of charge. And then we have another section called Other DVDs. And we're picking up some of the better DVDs that are out there on the Internet. You can link to them, ones that we think are really important. or website, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And, of course, our telephone number, we hope that you'll want to get, certainly our catalogs, and that you'll want to get the health catalog, the emergency food catalog, the regular catalog. We hope that you'll want to get the information and help us share it across America. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our vision and protection.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you.